Let's do this.
What is virtualization?
You're going to learn today.
Innovate like a startup. Deliver like an enterprise.
I hope you're coffeed up and ready because it's going to be a great day.
I know you're going to dig this.
Oh, yeah.
You're listening to the Virtually Speaking Podcast with Pedro Aero and John Nicholson.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Virtually Speaking Podcast, episode number 146. My name is Pete Fletcher, a.k.a. Pedro Aero, and joining me once again is Mr. John Nicholson. John, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing good. The weather's lovely outside. I think I'm going to go for a long walk after this podcast.
Yeah, man. Speaking of weather, holy cow, Twitter storm this past week, man. There has been all kinds of activity on Twitter from that, what's that Australian guy's name? Anthony Spiteri. Yeah, from Veeam. Holy cow, man. V10 is just all over the internet. People are talking about it. And it got me thinking, hey, we've been doing this deconstructing vSAN series, and man, we should pick that back up this week and do one all about availability. John, what do you think?
Yeah. No, these are just some of the most basic conversations that start out basic, but they deep dive in. And yeah, my Twitter feed was definitely blowing up with all the retweets about the V10 podcast.
Oh, yeah.
So
good stuff.
We're talking about availability there. Let's dig into it now.
Absolutely. Yeah. Hey, man, good story here for vSAN availability. And since we've already started this panel of vSAN experts, I wanted to bring back some regulars in that expert panel. So Glenn Sizemore, welcome back, my friend.
Hey, Pete, thanks for having me, man.
And Mr. Pete Keeler, welcome back to the expert panel.
Yeah, Pete, thanks for having me back again as well.
Yeah, so this is a topic that we talk about a lot. And a matter of fact, I just did a webcast a couple of weeks ago on vSAN best practices. And I was actually pretty surprised at some of the questions that came back even on that webcast. People are just asking basic questions like, why do I care? How does vSAN take care of me? Like, what policy do I need to have? Do I need to consider that? And it got me thinking, people truly don't understand how vSAN already takes care of most of this for you. But I think it's still important for us to dig deeper and break it down. Because, you know, as I always say, anybody that knows me will hear me say this, but, you know, simplicity is the ultimate sophistication. And I think that's kind of what vSAN is. Like, there's tons of sophistication there. And if you're just a regular customer and you are happy that things are working, and you've already got your failures to tolerate, that's great. But for the nerds that want to see what's going on, and you know, that's why this podcast is here. So why don't we dive a little deeper and talk about vSAN availability? Glenn Sizemore, why don't you kick us off and give us the 20,000 foot level of vSAN availability?
Sure, man. I'll go ahead and do the high level and then kick it off to my buddy Keeler, who can go ahead and dive us down beneath the surface and explain how it actually works. But at a high level, right, vSAN is an object store. And what that fundamentally means is that we are not dealing with availability on a per host basis. We don't look at it as a, here's how we're going to store a piece of data on this specific host and we're going to protect it. We fundamentally look at it as, here's a collection of hosts that are collectively responsible for storing and protecting a pool of data. And those hosts collaborate and work amongst themselves to solve that challenge, right? There's a whole bunch of stuff that gets into this, but for me, like, that's the first step. It's just acknowledging and taking that first step of realizing that with vSAN, your fault domain isn't a disk, right? It's not a RAID group. It's not an aggregate or a volume or any of the constructs we're used to dealing with in the storage world, if you've been doing this for a long time.
Yeah.
What we're dealing with instead is the host, right? vSAN looks at a host and says, all of the resources that are in this host could potentially disappear at any point in time together. So I can't put any two pieces of data on that host that I need for contingency purposes. And that's the fundamental building block that everything else kind of builds from. You agree with that, Pete? Is that where you would start the conversation? This is a question you typically answer more than I do.
Yeah, no, Glenn, I think that was a great way to start it. And I think, you know, focusing on the fact that vSAN is really built around this notion of an object store is a great place to start. Because when we think about resilience and durability of the data that we're placing on there, we have to think about how can it be constructed in such a way that we're going to initially reduce the amount of vulnerability that you have across a system. And one of the great things about this idea of this object store framework is that it reduces the potential vulnerability across the cluster, because we really treat where we place that data in this very discrete manner, where we have an object, you know, such as a VM, and it's going to be placed based off of vSAN's decision-making process on these specific hosts, but not necessarily sprinkled over all hosts. And as we scale, that really helps decouple that notion that is traditionally so difficult with storage systems in general, in terms of increasing that vulnerability.
Yeah, and that's really the thing. Like, because if you look at it and at a high level, you go, well, wait a minute, this doesn't make any sense, guys. Like, why didn't you just like just put RAID on the host and protect the data on the host? Why are we going through all this complexity? Why am I trying to stripe my data across multiple different hosts and have this subcomponent that is worrying about where individual bytes live and whether or not the same two bytes might exist on the same fault domain and be subject to the same failure principle?
Yeah.
Look, we built a shared nothing platform. Fundamentally, when you do that, you walk through the door saying that I am going to approach this problem completely differently than how it's been approached for the past 40 years of computing, right? So a lot of the things that you think about and know in the data storage space, they just don't apply when you start to build a true shared nothing platform, right? Unless you just want to throw the complexity at the customer. That is another way that you can do this. And there are systems that do that, right? A lot of the shared nothing, next generation data stacks platforms, they just throw it at the customer and they make it an application level problem. But if you're trying to build something where you've got a pool of hardware and any one piece of that hardware can disappear at any point in time, or you can just pull it out and replace it with a different component,
yeah,
without any interdependencies, right? That just fundamentally changes everything that you do from a data persistent storage platform. And the reason we did that is because it gave us two very important capabilities that you do not see elsewhere in the industry. And the first of which is scalability, right? Just fundamentally the scale, the number of objects, number of VMs, number of VMDKs that we deal with in a vSAN cluster is a different scale than you will ever encounter in a LUN or an NFS mount or anything like that, right? Mm-hmm. And the other thing that it gave us is just a completely different management scope. And that's why I launched with the object store conversation, because you know, we talked about this when I first joined VMware 3 years ago. But you know, fundamentally, the thing that's different about an object store is the way that you interact with your data. Instead of having to know all of the particulars about the specialties, right? Exactly where it lives, when you put it there, what the data protection mechanisms for it are. If you want to move it to another region, you have to imperatively do that data migration and all of those individual characteristics. In an object store, you just throw all that shit in the tagging rule and you let the data storage platform worry about the specifics, right? You've got a token that says, when I hand you this token, you're going to hand me back my data. And how the platform does that is not your problem.
Yeah.
And that's what vSAN has done. It has taken an incredibly complex problem, building a shared nothing persistent data storage platform, and made it a trivially easy administrative management task.
I feel like I've been spoiled by that abstraction, because I've been learning a lot about Kubernetes and containers lately, and suddenly learning that, like, oh my God, if I change a path, everything explodes. And this whole idea of like, oh, there's just a fixed path and everything, and then magically you can change RAIDs and do all these things. And I guess it's, you know, also there's, you know, some of the benefits of evols there, but there is so much gravity to storage placement in a lot, not just, you know, talking about containers, but so many different systems. And so being able to, you know, change the back end while the front end remains the exact same, it's like being able to completely replace a cylinder on a car while the engine's driving. It's a completely different practical experience when you really get in the weeds with a lot of different systems.
I like that.
But at the same time, right, it can be a little bit scary if you're a traditional storage guy. So with that in mind, let's just start picking this apart and explaining how vSAN actually solves these challenges. Because I know for me, like when I left my former, you know, storage job and came here, that was the big thing. Like the first month and a half was just doing a lot of learning and a lot of getting up to speed with, okay, but all right, how do we protect from silent data rot prevention? And how do we deal with unexpected power failure at a cluster scale? Like going in and digging into the actual data flows of how vSAN deals with this. And it was only upon that deep discovery that I found out, like, oh, okay, this is the same thing. They just solved it a completely different way. So let's walk through that tree, yeah?
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. So why don't we just start with the basics of object availability? You know, every VM is made up of objects. What does it take to make those objects available within vSAN? Glenn?
Yeah, that's a good point, Pete. We do need to take a second and drill into this, because this is one of those fundamental building blocks that is going to influence everything else from where we go. So fundamentally, the way that vSAN treats availability is it's done on a per object basis. So just to give you an idea, right? If you create a VMDK inside a VM, that VMDK is represented as an air quote object inside vSAN, right? The VM home would be another object. If you took a snapshot, your snapshot delta would be an object. So all of these elements that comprise your virtual machines in your virtual infrastructure, those are objects inside vSAN. Now, each one of those objects is physically comprised by what we call data components. These are just little logical chunks that reside out there inside vSAN.
Yep.
And the way that the system works is as long as we have more than 51% of those objects or those subsystem components present, then we have enough to have quorum and the object is available. If we don't have 51% of those components available, then we don't have enough for quorum, and therefore the data is inaccessible because we can't guarantee that we're dealing with the latest copy of the data. So if we put this in practical terms, if I'm dealing with a RAID 1 data set, for example, I have two data components and one witness copy. So if I lose any one host, I'm losing one of those underlying components. I still have two remaining. So that's more than 51%. The object remains available. If I have a RAID 6 data set, right, that has six data components on the back end, four data stripes, and then two parity copies.
Yep.
Yeah. So I can lose any two of those data components. I still have more than 50% of my data, and the object stays online. So fundamentally, just when you're talking about availability inside vSAN, it's important to recognize that it is done on a per object basis. So that means that if you ever do encounter a scenario where enough hardware fails in the right progression for us to actually lose availability, it will always be a partial outage. It is only going to impact the objects for which vSAN has lost that critical number of data components and is no longer able to maintain availability. The cluster as a whole is always online. It is impossible to take it down.
So yeah, that sounds simple for like a RAID 1. You think of one object for a VMDK can be made up of one or more components. And heck, we could go down into why and how many components make up each object. So what you're saying is we need to have at least 51% of quorum of the components that make up that object online in order for the VM to still be accessible?
Yeah. So Pete, actually what we're talking about here when we are referring to component availability is generally there's an association of what we refer to as votes with those respective components. Now, those can be weighted a little differently, and those are some of the nuances in how we have implemented this object-based storage. But the practical matter is we are looking and viewing the object to see if there is enough there to understand if it should be available. And if there is not enough there, we want to preemptively make it to where it is unavailable so that we don't compromise the data in any way.
Yeah, because the thing to bear in mind here, right, this is a shared nothing platform. So at every moment of every second for every single operation, vSAN has to always protect against Sprick Brain. It's not just like a traditional storage cluster where it's checking, is my partner alive, yes or no. Every single operation has to check and make sure that it is writing into a coherent cluster and it's not partitioned.
So this is where the beauty of this design really comes into play, because we don't have to try to come up with a system of quorum based off of a file system, where oftentimes that's a really complex scenario in which you're trying to figure out the total number of systems available and where is that data sprinkled. We are defining availability on a per object basis. And that is truly the beauty of when you have the opportunity to build this out in the right way, you own the code to the hypervisor, you're able to design it in a fashion that is flexible and scalable.
I like it.
So the thing I really like about this is as you start scaling really large clusters, I mean, people running a petabyte, 2 petabytes or something nuts there. If we were doing wide-striped in the past, RAID 5 or 6 in storage arrays, we had to make sure 100% that whatever our SLA was set, we never breached, because then we lost and had to recover 100 terabytes or 200 terabytes or a petabyte or whatever we placed in there. But if you do have a situation that exceeds the design criteria, it's nice that it's only a partial failure and one that gets to a certain degree exponentially smaller and as a percent impact the larger a cluster gets. That helps control the unexpected. Like, it's that classic people start saying, well, what if this? Well, what if this? What if this? And then I'm like, where's your backups? But it's nice if you do get to that situation where your data center, you do have three hosts catch fire And so, you know, RAID 6 isn't going to protect you, but you had, you know, 30 nodes. You're not recovering all 4,000 VMs simultaneously. You're reducing and helping with that recovery plan. I mean, obviously, you should still have proper DR, be ready to fire everything on and things like that. But this does help mitigate the unexpected.
Yeah. And as we're going to get into later, right? I mean, ultimately, you are responsible for telling vSAN how survivable you want this data to be. And if you say that you only want to survive a single failure and then your data center encounters two or three, well, it's kind of your fault, right?
Yeah, that's fair. All right. So now that we understand what it takes for components and objects of a VM to be available, maybe it'll help to understand a little bit more about what actually happens with those objects as it traverses through vSAN. Pete, maybe you can help us walk through maybe the anatomy of an IO from a VM perspective.
Yeah, sure. Sounds good, Pete. So when we are talking about VM reads and writes that are requested by that VM, of course, it always originates from the VM. And that's going to originate just in the very same way as it would in a traditional storage. But from there, it's going to run through the stack, the vSAN stack, and make the determination based off of the assigned storage policy that is for the data of that VM, and then work through the process of, if I'm going to be issuing a write, where should that write go to? So for instance, if there is a write that is issued from the guest VM at that vSCSI layer, it's going to run through our distributed object manager client. From there, it's going to look for what we refer to as the owner, and then make the decision on where those writes should go based off of the assigned storage policy. So if we have a level of failure to tolerate of one, then it's going to choose two separate locations to make that synchronous write actually occur. When it runs through the lower layers of the vSAN storage stack, it's going to be eventually acknowledged by the caching and buffering tier within those physical devices within those selected hosts. And again, it's only for those selected hosts. Once it receives those synchronously, then it's going to send those write acknowledgements back to the VM so that then it can process the subsequent write IOs. When we think about that, we need to make sure that those are consistent. And therefore, that's why we always make sure that that is a synchronous write. We do not do any eventually consistent IO processing for vSAN.
And for me, this is the first step that everyone needs to understand, right? So fundamentally, there is never any IO that is in flight and at risk. The way that vSAN deals with this is when that VM issues the write, right? As Pete said, it looks at the policy. The policy tells it how available it needs to be and how many copies it needs to have. It then uses those rules to figure out where it's going to place the data. And only after it has secured the write in the local cache or buffer tier for the designated hosts, does it act back to the client and say, yes, this write has been completed. So we have the same exact write coherence that you see in ACID compliance that you see in a traditional data storage controller, right? So just first and foremost, you're getting the same level of protection. And that means that as soon as the guest OS gets the ACK back, like you could cut power to the Eastern Seaboard of the United States and you're fine, right? Because it's secured on disk, we're fine. Everything's going to be okay. If something were to happen while we're still working through that write, right, and we lose the cluster, well, the guest never got the acknowledgement back. So the transaction was still in flight. So that's just the first step. Hmm. The first step that I think we really need to understand is, yes, this is a distributed system. Yes, this is object storage, but it is a distributed object storage platform that is giving you ACID compliant enterprise storage consistency.
When you think about that level of consistency and you know the reason why there may in fact be some inconsistency is due to a failure, then it's worth asking the question of, well, what is a failure in the first place? That oftentimes gets glossed over during this conversation. Is it a discrete device living on a specific host? Is it a network partition? Some of the most challenging troubleshooting issues out there with regards to data consistency are regarding networking partitions. So These are some of the things that we have to factor in the design. And the good news is, from an architecture perspective, vSAN has those things in place so that the user doesn't have to worry about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's a good point. Does vSAN react to every failure the same way?
No, this is honestly where this conversation starts to get a little bit complex, right? Because, and this is why I started the conversation at a high level and invite people to, when you move into vSAN, think of yourself more as a valet and less of, you know, a professional driver or an Uber driver, you know, if you want to use that analogy, because you really are letting go to a certain degree of control and trusting the platform to deal with all the minutiae that, that you traditionally deal with upfront when you're designing the data storage platform, right? That's just handled on the back end. This really is data storage management via artillery. You're just lobbing requests over the hill. vSAN catches those requests and then makes it so on its schedule as it can.
That almost sounds like a desired state, a desired result.
Yeah, it's not a coincidence. Model? That they're, yeah, it's not a coincidence, right? But look, to ship is to choose, right? And to go down one door is to close another, or to go down one path is to close the door to the other. And ultimately, the way that vSAN has accomplished this task of delivering both of these worlds simultaneously is to make a couple of small concessions architecturally. The first and most important that we touched on last time we talked with the efficiency show is the two-tiered architecture. The fact that we are using a dedicated flash storage device as our first stop for any new traffic. Any new writes goes directly into that LSOM local cache. And because of that, it enables us to take what is otherwise a really big variable host, right? Like if you think of a disk group, there's a whole bunch of resources in there. You don't know how busy it is. You don't know what's going on. You don't know if the media is in the middle of in a write erasure cycle or anything like that. It takes that all that variability and instead just makes it this two-step kind of problem for the storage system. The first step is just get a copy of the data on a data persistent storage target that can survive a power cycle, right? And then the second step is what we talked about last time on our deconstructed, where we want to go in as efficiently as possible, get that write down into the capacity tier for long-term persistence.
Good stuff. All right, so let's talk resiliency. Now, I know vSAN handles failures differently. vSAN is intelligent and has the ability to determine different types of failure and act accordingly. So why don't we start with a very simple one, say a disk failure. How does vSAN handle a traditional disk failure? Does it react the same way for a disk failure than it does for, say, a host being missing or a network partition?
Yeah, so I think the best way to sort of sort through this failure scenario is really to understand that they fall in two general categories. Ones that we're going to be able to identify explicitly what is that failure, and then all of the other failures, which are, you know, this thing may be absent. I'm not able to talk to it. What may be wrong? I don't know, but this is the current state that it's in. So in that first category, that would be something like a physical device that has failed explicitly. And then that would be sending like a SCSI sense code to the system. And we would be able to recognize that and understand that that is a failed physical device. Those ones are fairly clear. The other failures are not so clear because you're not quite sure if somebody simply unplugged a server or if there is a systemic issue with a host, whether it be hardware or software. In those cases, that's where we're going to handle this scenario of understanding that we know it may just be a transient communication issue. So we're going to wait for a moment. We're going to see if this works this out. And it's really analogous to an all pass down scenario that you would see in a traditional storage environment.
Sure.
And that's where this notion of a timer comes in. To help us better understand, is this error condition something that it looks like it's not going to come back from, and therefore we can take action on it?
Yeah, I like to think about this as, you know, are they dead? Are they asleep? Or are they just in bad cell coverage, right? Because that's really what vSAN cluster is trying to figure out. All right, I've lost access to this data component that is part of an availability set. Is it gone? I.e., did I get DDH failure errors and I know that the media target that it's sitting on has actually failed and I'm never going to get it back, in which case let's pre-fail and start the rebuild? Or is it just sleeping and, you know, the host is in the middle of a reboot and it's going to be back shortly? Or is it just in bad cell coverage and we're dealing with a network outage and none of the above has actually failed, and as soon as it gets back in good cell coverage, I'll be able to talk to him again? And because vSAN is kind of taken this two-step problem and said, hey, Mr. Storage Administrator and Mr. HCI Data Center Administrator, I'm going to deal with this for you. the tolerances for actually declaring something dead aren't quite as tight as what some people are used to. Because if you're dealing with a dedicated storage controller where everything's multipath redundant and you've got multiple different ways to validate that you're communicating with all of your devices, then you can preemptively declare things dead and, you know, trigger on that failure. But again, vSAN is shared nothing. We're using a TCP/IP network to connect all of these hosts so that they can communicate and coordinate their actions. And because of that, that means that the network might just temporarily go down for a little bit. But we don't want to, because of what we're talking about with the penalty, we do not want this system to preemptively just start doing rebuilds. Data gravity is a real thing. Anytime the system decides that it's going to pick a 4K block up and it's going to move it somewhere else, every part of the data center has to pay for that movement. Mm-hmm. So it's important that the system not just be flinging data around because it's not sure what's going on.
Oh, okay. So that's why it doesn't just immediately rebuild as soon as there is any absence. It doesn't just kick in a rebuild right away.
Well, no, but because the other thing too is, remember, like vSAN is solving for the availability challenge a different way, right? We're solving this at the component level of the object. So if I've got a VM with three components, right? Two are full data copies. The third one is a witness copy. And one of those data components is on a host and that host dies and it does not come back. Well, the VM continues to operate because it has a full copy of the data, right? At the object level, we're still online. Now, if the cluster determines that it is not going to be able to get back to that data component for whatever reason, we're able to preemptively determine that the hardware is dead and it's never coming back, or an administrator goes in there and says, hey, it's dead, it's never coming back, then vSAN gets to work and it does the rebuild immediately. But out of the box, it assumes it's 2 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday and no one's watching the data center and that host might come back. So it waits 60 minutes to see if we're just in the middle of a long reboot, because this happens, right? You'll just have a power outage in a rack and one of these hosts with half a terabyte of memory and 48 cores bounces.
Oh, yeah.
It takes 45 minutes for that thing to come back up.
Oh, dude.
Well, yeah. One really common scenario that hit me recently was DIM hard failures. Like memory DIMs, as we start stuffing a terabyte of RAM into hosts, you end up with like, oh, host rebooted from a bad DIM. And, you know, I had to go sort that out later and then went down the rabbit hole of learning what reliable memory was. But there's lots of transient issues that can happen. I mean, think about your networking team. How many of you have networking teams out there that operate under the YOLO principle of, if we reboot the stack quickly, no one will notice? Which I guess, you know, back when Fibre Channel was a separate dedicated switch and we kept those YOLOing idiots away from it, we were fine. But now that Ethernet is actually transporting important things like storage, you know, 45 second outages or 1 minute outages or 2 minute outages actually matter. So,
oh, yeah.
It's something we have to be mindful of.
Heck, I've been in my lab all weekend. I'm working on something that we can't talk about yet. But hey, lots of reboots of servers. And every time I was thinking, man, I am sure glad that there's not a bunch of rebuilds happening right now. You know, you have that option inside of maintenance mode. You can, if you want to do a full migration, that's fine. But boy, when I know I'm just rebooting a server for, you know, a quick firmware upgrade or something, I don't really need to have, all my data being rebuilt on another host just for a quick reboot.
And Pete, in that whole time, have you always rebooted the right server? Because I thought I saw one of my hosts go offline. And there is nothing like realizing you're in the wrong out-of-band management. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, this is the whole point of this system, right? I mean, look, out of the box, vSAN, as we've said multiple times, and this really is the thing to recall. Out of the box, vSAN is saying, you don't have to worry about any of this. I'm going to worry about it for you. It is my problem. I will make sure that your data is available, that you are highly durable, and that your application is going to be online. But if you want to get in there and mitigate and completely absolve some of the downsides and challenges that exist with this system, the tools are there, right? It's not like we're dealing with compromises. It's not like, oh, we can't do X, right? It's just, this is how the system dealt with it. We built an object store. The object store works off dedicated data persistence principles of either mirroring or erasure coding. Now, if you want to ensure that while you're doing maintenance on a host, that you never even have the possibility of one of those components not being available, we can preemptively move all of those component objects off of that host, put them elsewhere in the cluster, and we don't ever have to worry about any outages. But we can also sit there and just say, you know what? This is my lab and I don't want to wait 2 hours to evacuate this data. We're just going to bounce the host and I'm going to ensure accessibility. vSAN, as long as you have enough objects to stay online, keep the workload up. I don't want to do a bunch of data motion. Which one of those is appropriate is highly dependent upon what the workload is.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And this is the point with vSAN. It's not making you choose. We're not an or platform. We're not saying we'll do this or that, right? We are an and platform. We're saying, yes, we can do that, What is your question, Mr. Customer? And to the availability concerns, that's why this is tunable. Look, if you've got a highly questionable workload that cannot compromise, you must be highly available, high performance, low latency with no durability risk. We'll deploy that workload using a 3 failure to tolerate RAID 1 mirroring policy and walk away with a smile on your face because nothing's ever going to happen. You are safe from everything. Right.
We actually have a customer I talked to who's doing FTT at 2. So they're making 3 copies. And then they were running FT. So mirroring those 3 copies into a second set. I was like, you guys are making 6 copies of data, right? Like, this is kind of wasteful. Yeah. And they're like, well, if this goes down, humans die. I'm like, all right, 6 copies it is. Like,
exactly. It depends, right? Exactly. If we're talking about a SQL database for an internal auditing system, like maybe you don't want to spend that. But if it's the back end for a heart monitoring process, yeah, who cares about a little data storage?
Pete, pull the tape. That clip of who cares about a little bit of storage with that, like, that passion and gusto, that is going on the soundboard. There is no way that is not going on the soundboard.
I'm isolating the clip as we speak. Sweet. So on the topic of rebuilds, there are lots of different types of rebuilds. And I think one we haven't addressed yet is disk groups, right? Disk groups, there's this idea, every host has at least one disk group. vSAN, if you do a quick config, it's going to look at the amount of disks that you have. It might create 2 disk groups for you. And certainly 2 disk groups are great because there's some performance advantages. There's also some minimizing your failure domain, things like that. But Pete Keeler, what happens if a disk group fails?
Yeah, so if a physical device within a disk group fails, the data that was residing on that disk will be absent. It will be recognized from vSAN as being absent. And therefore, after a fixed amount of time, then that will be rebuilt at some other location to regain that level of prescribed resilience assigned to that specific object. So it's really cut and dry when we think about that sort of a failure. Now, if you have a failure of the flash device that is serving as the caching and buffering tier, then the data that resides within that disk group will basically fall under the very same rules. It will recognize that that data is absent at that point, and then with that given fixed amount of time, will rebuild to regain that level of compliance there. Now, if we run into a condition where you are running a deduplication and compression and you have a physical device fail, that is where it will treat it as that single logical unit. And we do that because we are using deduplication to take advantage of improving that level of space efficiency. So it's going to sprinkle that data everywhere, and it's going to make these references or these pointers to these blocks that were duplicates so that you can save on space.
Yep.
So that's why that sort of logic exists in the first place.
So it kicks off a rebuild, and rebuilds are, certainly there's a performance penalty for that, correct?
Well, a rebuild itself is a series of reads and writes that are going to be occurring from one host over to another. And these reads and writes run through the very same vSAN stack that normal guest VM IO would occur. But the beauty is this, is that because we are fully integrated right into the hypervisor and we use our own unique scheduler, this is where we can distinguish what kind of a write IO is that? And is this, and should it be more important than this write IO? And this is really the secret sauce behind how vSAN employs this resynchronization process. We can ensure that when we want to regain that level of availability that's been assigned to that given VM, we can do so in a way that we're not going to compromise the integrity or the performance of those VMs that are being rebuilt.
So you're saying vSAN is intelligent enough to know the different types of IO and then act differently based on that?
Exactly. The scheduler that is used within vSAN, we recognize these different IO types and we're able to adjust according to the priorities that are set forth if there is some contention. Now, that's sort of the beauty of all of this, is we can recognize when there is contention throughout that storage stack. If there's no contention, hey, make sure all of that data is pushed as quickly as possible. If there is contention, then we can balance and prioritize that IO so that we ensure that the adequate amount of performance is given for front-end VM IO processing.
So to be clear, what you're saying, contention, so I've got a workload, my VM workload is contending with those background operations, and that's when vSAN can determine between the different IO that's coming in and say, there's contention between these applications and the background operations, and then make decisions accordingly?
Yeah, the contention that I'm referring to is generally referring to the physical devices and the demands that are set on those physical devices that we run through. And of course, it sits at the bottom of that storage stack. So in understanding, for instance, that if the caching and buffering tier is being backed up by, a number of resynchronization activities that are occurring, that we can pull that back and we can tweak and tune the scheduler at first to make sure that that IO is reprioritized to ensure that we have sufficient resources for those VM IOs.
Yeah, when we say multiple different IOs, we're specifically vSAN knows the difference between internal vSAN IO and VM requests that are being serviced for the purpose of doing vSCSI reads and writes for guest workload. And when we have two operations that are destined for the same target and only one can complete, i.e. contention, the system is smart enough to say guest IO continues. Now, at the same time, it also is smart enough to know, and this is what we mean when we say scale, right? Just a slight step backwards in the conversation. When we say scale, we're not necessarily talking about like hundreds of thousands and millions of VMs and just millions and thousands of nodes. Like, it's not about the size in a lot of ways, right? It's about the number of things that can go wrong and the system, it can just deal with it without a catastrophic failure, right? Because of how vSAN has been constructed, the difference between losing an individual host and an entire site in a stretch cluster is the same from Dom's perspective, right? The vSCSI stack inside vSphere knows no difference. It's just the fault domains that vSAN is working with, the number changes dramatically, right? And it has to work within the free space that's available. And the reason I bring this up and the reason that I think this is important is because the system is inherently as smart as we can make it. And this is code that has never stopped and will never stop being optimized. So when we take a look at it today in the latest versions of vSAN, we already have a bunch of features, right? Like resynchronization fairness, the thing that we're talking about right now that will actually inject latency into the vSAN rebuild process so that the guest IO can continue to run. That's new code that we wrote to make the resynchronization more efficient, right? And we're just going to continue to fine-tune this process. But the thing from a customer perspective is, this isn't your problem.
Yeah.
Honestly, I don't like using the word rebuild because vSAN doesn't have a rebuild. Rebuild doesn't exist. Rebuild is a concept in a traditional RAID stripe system where you lose one of your media targets.
And a hot spare jumps up and says, pick me.
Exactly.
and then you got to go stare through at that 8 terabyte drive for the next 4 days.
Look, there's different ways that you can parallelize that activity and different vendors are better at rebuilds. But fundamentally, that's not what vSAN's doing, right? As Keeler mentioned, right? What vSAN does is it notices one of these component objects is either absent, out of date, or just completely, inaccessible for some reason. And it goes through whatever steps it needs to get back to a healthy copy of whatever that component is. If there's another copy, it'll just do a streaming reads from that copy into the new ones. If we're dealing with erasure coding and there isn't another copy, then we'll reconstitute from parity to recreate the missing component. But as a storage administrator, you don't think about any of this, right? You just monitor the cluster. And if it turns out that your cluster latency start to you log in one day and you get an alert at the cluster, you got a yellow light. You're like, what is this? High latency. Click that. Go into your vSAN performance diagnostics. Oh, crap. Look at this. I lost a disk group on host 4 and the system's rebuilding 6 terabytes of data. Look at that. This cluster's so busy. Well, why is it so busy? Because it's a shared nothing object store. That rebuild is evenly distributed across every single disk in the cluster. The system is able to simultaneously rebuild with as many resources as it has available. And because it's a hyperconverged platform, if it turns out there aren't any resources available because it's all being used by running workload, then that resynchronization is smart enough to say, well, this might take 3 days, but I'm not going to impact the workload. I'm going to sit in the background and slowly chew my way through this problem getting the data back to full compliance with my FTTD and policy declarations without impacting production workload. And that's the thing that I don't think people understand. We could have easily written software that delivered exactly what you get with a traditional two-tiered architecture inside vSAN. But we'd use the same amount of resources, right? We'd need a half terabyte of memory and 48 cores and all of the resources that you see traditional storage systems consume and or systems that use intermediary hosting processes, right? The reason that vSAN is so efficient, the reason that we're able to do this with so little is because it is so intelligent. It's aware of what happens in the other parts of the stack, and therefore it can ensure that it's not stepping on anyone else's toes. So yeah, there's a couple of different trade-offs there, right? And it's important to understand like what rebuilds look like and what exactly you'd have to do. But I think it's important to keep this in perspective. It's not this big trade-off of like, well, you know, I saved a bunch of money, but cross fingers, this never happens, right? It's a trade-off in the, we chose to go down this other path. And because we did so, we don't have to think about data storage, right? We just kind of throw it at the policy level. Oh, we're not getting enough persistent or enough performance at the application. Let me change my stripe width. I'll just logically expand the number of physical components that this workload is attached to without having to get down into the data storage management. You can't do that without the kind of system that we built, and the downsides to that platform are what some people like to rat hole on sometimes. But I don't really, again, I don't think it's a weakness. I just think it's a consequence of how the platform was built. At the end of the day, if you turn it on and you can read your data storage platform is doing its job. That's it.
That is beautiful.
Yeah, you know, Glenn, I think that really mimics too what the key charter of any IT organization is, which is really the availability of the data and the respective services that those things render. And how we provide that level of resilience is, you know, we're certainly going into the weeds here and helping others understand what that is. But what really matters is making sure that that data is available. And if there is some compromise in that, that we are able to regain that level of resilience and availability and do so in a very eloquent way that doesn't interfere with other systems that are running.
I mean, if we interfere, then you have to think about it. And if you have to think about it, then it's not hyper-converged. Hard stop.
Hey, I started with it and I'm going to finish with it. Simplicity is the ultimate sophistication. I mean, to me, that is, you know, that is vSAN. Sweet. Gentlemen, oh man, we could probably talk about 3 more hours just on availability, but I think that's a good vSAN deconstructed episode. Any thoughts? Do you think we should cover anything else before we land this plane, John?
No, one thing I just want to plug is the sessions that Pete and I have done previously along this line. The vSAN Life of the IO, it originally started as a session I did with Duncan.
Oh, yeah.
And then Pete has done an amazing job of doing crazy research on this every year. And you'll see a session that Pete and I both do together at VMworld. And man, he like some of the stuff that gets in there and sometimes some of the Q&A is just hilarious too. Like some people really want to go into the weeds. So
Pete is right.
I'd encourage you to look at the sessions as well as if you're coming to VMworld, obviously sessions aren't in, but hopefully we'll be doing one again. So sign up.
I like it. I like it. And for those of you wondering, it is Pete Keeler that did that session. People are always mixing Pete Keeler and I. So yes, I do the podcast and Pete is the performance nerd. Good stuff. All right. Yeah. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining the vSAN expert panel again. I do plan on doing many more of these vSAN deconstructed episodes. And yeah, we'll just keep doing these. I think these are a lot of fun. And as I said, the beauty is for most customers, it really doesn't matter to know this level of detail. But I think it's fun to realize that there is some serious sophistication that's deep in the weeds.
Yeah, it's fun to nerd out on how things work. I just, you know, don't get wrapped around the axle because you really don't need to know any of this stuff.
Yep. Good stuff. All right, well, that music tells me it's time to go. And so if you want to get in touch with us, send us an email at podcast@vmware.com. You can subscribe to us on your podcast app of choice by searching Virtually Speaking Podcast. You can catch this and all episodes at vspeakingpodcast.com. A big thanks to Pete and Glenn, our vSAN expert panel. We're back next week, but until then, bye for now.
VSAN is smarter than you.
See.
Enough of this jibber jabber.